It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay. Picture it. Sicily, 1987. America launches the last of America's deep space probe. No, wait, sorry. But YouTube ad pops up.
Okay.
It is a woman who, at first glance, I would say, is of Asian descent.
Okay.
She looks Asian. And she appears to be traveling and getting off, like, the London Underground. And so I'm curious, because I don't know what this ad's about. I've never seen this ad before, so I think it gave me the option to skip, but I'm like, let's keep going. I want to see where this is headed. And she's wandering around, like coming out of the underground and going places. And she arrives at a place where it appears that she is some sort of nurse or medical aide or something to an older lady. And she takes her, it wheels her around these grounds and things, eventually comes back. There's also a weird section then where it seems like there's an implication that the old lady died or something, because like our main person is sort of looking at a room and looking sad, and you just see the door to the room. So I don't know what that's about. I've only seen this once, so I don't know. But then we have this woman walking by a doorway, and there is an old woman who I think is the same old woman in sitting up in bed, surrounded by several younger people, invoking that this is her family come to visit potentially. And there's a pause. I should say the older woman, white lady. Everybody else white. And there's a weird tense moment where everybody's looking at her and she's looking at them. And then the old lady smiles and says, goes like this. And she says, "This is my friend." And then the lady comes in, and she smiles, and she sits on the edge of the bed and, like, takes the old lady's hand. And the woman says, "She's from the Philippines." And then everybody else sort of smiles, and I think we get some, like, soundless, like, you see them chatting a little bit or whatever. And then eventually you cut to, again, our protagonist leaving the building, sort of smiling to herself. And it comes up on the screen. "I am Charm. I am the Philippines." And that's the end of the ad. See, my brain made the expression you have right now. That's what my brain looked like in here when I saw it.
And so you said that it seemed like it was in the UK. It was the old woman.
Like it was in the UK. I mean, the beginning definitely, and then yeah, the old lady had a British accent.
British accent. Okay.
pair this, and this could be coincidence, but I have never had, to my knowledge, any YouTube ads vis-a-vis the Philippines. I have not recently started seeing videos about the Philippines, but I also, a week or two ago, had an ad for Philippines Airline that I had never had before. So I feel like the Philippines might be on like a PR push right now. I don't know. I don't keep up on the news, and I certainly don't keep up on Filipino news. Last I knew, they had an absolutely insane military strongman populist of a leader who was going around talking about how he was going to kill every single drug dealer in the country and things like that. So I'm wondering, like, is he gone now? And now they're trying to, like, not look crazy? I don't know. I saw this days ago, and only last night did I get an inkling of what the ad could be.
What's that?
All right. I mean, I don't, this sounds weird, but the ad could essentially be saying, hey, other countries, hire people from the Philippines to come work in your sort of low-level jobs for probably way cheaper than it would cost to hire people in your own country, because we're good at that. Because I do know, historically, countries, companies, cruise ships hire people from less, more impoverished countries, the Philippines being one of them, to do jobs people from more affluent countries don't want to do for less money than people from affluent countries would be willing to do. So, but it seems weird to have an ad for that. But I don't know what else the ad would be.
So, do you have a VPN?
I do not. No, that's not. And this was also on my TV, which even if I had a VPN, I don't think it would be there. But no.
I've never heard of this ad campaign. I'd have to really look into it to know. I mean, I don't, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't understand, like, who made it.
GM Charm. GM the Philippines. Yeah, it's very strange. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world. I figured this out. Okay, basically, imagine Boss Hogg and Enos, the characters from Dukes of Hazzard, attempting to do like a low-key community theater version of old Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, like 2,000-year-old man, kind of the double act sort of vibe, but it's a podcast. That's what this is. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 635. I was going to say I was Enos or Boss Hogg, but I really can't figure out which one I am.
You really can't. The two of us. One of us is Enos. One of us is Boss Hogg.
Right.
You can't figure that one out.
No.
I never thought I'd say this, especially not on a podcast, but I think your therapist is bad.
Yeah, maybe.
If you, William, can't tell if you're Enos or Boss Hogg, you need better mental health professionals. Where I come from, children know by the time they can walk if they're Enos or Boss Hogg. It's just fundamental to our identity. The fact that you are this old without ever having figured it out. I mean,
that's good.
For those of you just joining, what episode number did you say it was?
635, didn't I?
I don't know. That's why I asked.
I don't remember either. Does that make me Enos?
I mean, it makes us both something. I don't know why. The other day I went and sort of tracked down the Tuning Japanese podcast, which, among other people, longtime listener and arch nemesis of the show, Azure Talon, is involved. I'm pretty sure they started after us. They definitely have fewer episodes because they frequently, like, stop for a while, as many podcasts are wont to do, as opposed to us. I think they are so much, I mean, I know they're better off. They've actually had, like, celebrity interviews and shit, like, and some of their stats are available. They're kicking the shit out of us. But to be fair, there is one thing I know. They actually edit. So that would make a difference. But
yeah, so then we could do that whole bit over again, and you could you could do Boss Hogg and Roscoe. See, then I'd know I'm Roscoe for sure.
Roscoe does feel like the overlap in the Venn diagram between Boss Hogg and Enos. You mix them together, you got Roscoe.
You kind of, yeah. Then yeah. I'd know. Totally know Roscoe then. Whatever.
I'm a little bit Enos. I'm a little bit Boss Hogg. My point is, we are professionals. If you're just joining us for the first time ever, welcome. Here's how the show is. We have a hat. It's magic in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people write in to that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with whatever the crap they want, some questions, some comments, some topics, some diatribes, occasional pictures, which don't translate to podcasts real well, but, you know, they're there. And then we, the hat magically forwards the emails to us. We read them, talk about them, do that, and then stop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a podcast. And I will say, William doesn't like any of you, but I try really hard to sort of follow through on most comments if I feel that there is something to say. Recently Craig and Jazz have posted comments. Craig's is a little older, is on an older episode. Jazz went into great detail about the detective fiction thing that we talked about last time. This week has been insane, largely relating to people to whom I am close and not me, so I will not be talking about it on here, I'm afraid, because not my place, but it has caused my life to be also insane. So I haven't gotten to those yet. I will, but I apologize. I will soon. You both put a lot of effort into writing those, especially Jazz. My God. So I will get back to them, but I apologize.
I didn't see Jazz's thing until just now.
Did you see Craig's thing?
Mm-mm.
Doesn't like you. Doesn't like any. That's what he says.
I'm a terrible person. But this thing Jazz posted was back on. It was yesterday.
Back then.
Way back yesterday.
Seems like it was just yesterday that yesterday happened.
Yep.
On later seasons of or later series of Taskmaster, the introduction to Alex frequently includes Greg talking about things that Alex said in confidence that are always like really awful things about how like veterans are cowards and women shouldn't be able to vote and things like that, just to make Alex uncomfortable. And I think about that kind of thing when I tell people that you hate all the listeners and you told me about that. It's a very similar vibe. You have a lot of little Alex Horn energy about you.
Mm. Okay.
And like little Alex Horn, we call you little, but you're actually quite tall.
Yeah.
How was your week?
It's been okay. So we started watching Only Murders in the Building.
Oh God. And yeah. How's
really
that going?
Good. No, it's really good. Ooh.
Yeah.
You had heard different?
We watched it and stopped watching it because we really did not like it.
Oh man, like really a lot. Like what didn't you like about it?
It absolutely 100% felt like a ego-driven vanity project for the three main people who just spend their time on screen going, "Aren't I a brilliant actor?"
I didn't get that impression really. I thought Martin Short did a really good job, actually, as far as. I mean, better than he usually does.
I very rarely like Martin Short.
Me too. I think he's good in this.
I will say this is one of the things I have liked him more in, but the whole thing just feels so pointlessly hubristic. I got very, very quickly didn't care because it just looked like the three of them essentially mugging for the camera, especially Steve Martin. Steve Martin looks like he's just like, I'm just going to be the guy. About the point we had some weird physical comedy involving certain remains in a freezer, that was the moment where I was checked out. I was like, not for me. But we are definitely in the minority. It's very popular. It's getting or has gotten a third season. Like, it's a thing.
So. Yeah, we really liked it. In fact, all the stuff you said, I expected it was going to be. We've been avoiding it because it's like, this is going to be terrible. We knew it was popular, but I thought this is just, well, you know, they're all executive.
But I suspect I told you a couple years ago when we tried to watch it.
Maybe. They're all executive producers on it. So that's what I thought too. I thought, oh God, this is going to be awful. And my expectations were so very low that when it was actually halfway decent, I'm like, oh, I mean, I think Steve Martin's performance is actually kind of interesting and subtle compared to what he's usually does. I felt like Martin Short's performance was more crafted than it usually is. I mean, usually he's just some comedic character and there's not a lot of depth to it, but it's like,
yeah, he tends to do very broad bits. Yeah.
Like he thought it out. Like he gets, this character has depth is in terms of how he thinks about the character and portrays it. Now, Gomez doesn't seem, I don't know her, you know, like for all I know, she's killing it or something. I mean, it seems like she's channeling the Wednesday role that she didn't get, but
she is playing a disaffected millennial thing. So it becomes hard to tell, like, is she playing that role really well or is she just being that way? Like,
right. Yeah. But it doesn't bother me. It's just like, I'm just probably the least impressed with her. But, you know, I've seen those two do things before together. And I've pretty much never been impressed. I mean, I'll see what they're doing. It's like, okay, that's kind of funny or that's cute or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But I've never been like blown away. Like, oh, I've got to see everything that these two do together. That's why I didn't watch it, because I thought I knew exactly what it was going to be. But it seems different to me than the stuff they've done before. And it seems, I don't know. I don't see, at least for those two, I don't know about Gomez, but for those two, I do not see two people dialing it in. I see two people that have really like thought about this and made it something interesting, but maybe I'm just bringing a whole bunch of stuff to it. I don't know. Maybe part of it has to do with, it's like a true crime podcast kind of thing, which I don't listen to true crime podcasts, but I think I'm sort of on the peripheral of true crime people. I wouldn't call myself a true crime fan, but I mean, I watch.
You heard it here. William hangs out with a lot of murderers.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's a certain kind of person that's a true crime person. They listen to the podcast, like they portray in the show. I'm not like those people, I don't think, but I do, I read and watch things that are related to, you know, understanding certain crimes that have happened or certain criminals. So I'm at least on the outside of that group. So maybe I have enough. I mean, it's part of the reason why I do this Hunt a Killer stuff and I enjoy it, right? So I'm probably close enough to that scene that maybe it resonates with me in a way that it doesn't with you. I don't
know. So, if decide which side you're on, those of you at home, if you love Tony best, then hate the show, even if you haven't seen it. And if you love William best, you should go check it out. Don't let us know which you decided, because it'll hurt one of our feelings. I mean, it has to by sort of definition. So
I won't hurt my feelings. It's okay. You can say whatever you
want. All right. then as long as it's me, let us know.
Yeah, just stroke Tony's ego. I'm fine with it. But I mean, I you know, it's like I said, I was kind of impressed with what Martin Short did, and I enjoy being impressed with what an actor's doing. But like I maybe I'm bringing something to it. I have no idea. But we'll probably keep watching it. But that's really the only, I mean, aside from school, that's the only interesting thing that's been happening, I think. How was your week?
I don't know. Let's find out.
Oh, you still have your list?
Oh, yeah. No, I love this thing.
Let's find out.
By the end of tonight, I will hopefully be done with Horizon Forbidden West. I'm real, real close. So that, oh crap, sometimes I don't remember what I wrote or why.
You probably let yourself forget it after you write it down because you're,
yeah, reading. No, the problem is this is a movie that we saw. Oh I remember. Okay, I got two movies and TV show to talk about.
Okay,
here we go. We saw 1973 thriller classic starring Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, Don't Look Now. This is, I sort of knew on the peripheral about this in the past, but something recently brought it back to my attention, and it is one of those that is considered a classic, and is marked as inspiration for a lot of other filmmakers that came later and things like that.
Okay. I've never heard of it.
It is the story of a couple who one of their children dies in an accident. And then shortly after, they are in Venice because of his work, and it's them, a lot of it is their relationship and sort of dealing with that afterwards, but then weird theoretically supernatural or possibly just psychological things start happening. I read up on it, and the history of its creation is fascinating, the history of its filming is fascinating. At the time it came out, it stirred a lot of controversy. There is what was apparently at the time considered a very explicit sex scene. It is not a very explicit sex scene by today's standards at all. But there are components to it that caused a lot of controversy at the time. It was fairly well received, but not by everybody in the day. It has since been sort of reevaluated even better. Apparently Roger Ebert famously didn't like it, and then like 20 years later watched it like shot by shot and wrote a whole thing about how he was wrong, which is pretty impressive for Roger Ebert. I had learned the base premise and the ending. There, the ending is interesting, and I had learned about that, and I thought this could be cool, so let's watch it, and we watched it. Neither of us really liked it. I get everything that has been said positive about it, mostly. It is very likely a groundbreaking and very interesting piece of film craft. I found it confusing and unenjoyable. So I don't do with that what you will. I don't think it's a bad movie. I think it'd be really weird to say like I'm the one who knows, but like there's a certain level. We'll be talking about the reasons I would watch something. Mostly entertainment, and beyond that, you know, lesson or perspective shift that is important to me. None of that do I get from this. I can appreciate why other people would find certain things, especially the way it's shot, the way it's edited is a very big deal. And I can see why people would find that interesting and amazing. Nope.
I find that I'm this way with lots of art in general, where if there's something that about the craft itself that's involved in appreciating the piece, and that's mostly like, oh, it's the way the person used color, or, you know, for a painting, or there's something about a sculpture, or it's the way they did this, I can appreciate that other people can appreciate that, especially other painters, other sculptors, other filmmakers, whatever. But I do have to say that it doesn't, it has to appeal to a more popular taste for it to appeal to me. I have to admit, I'm just not.
And there's also, there's levels, and it varies for me, but like, if I'm in a story, this is a good example. And I don't feel this is particularly spoiling. So it's, like I said, set in Venice. Donald Sutherland is American and Julie Christie is British. Also, their characters. I realize, wait, I'm just saying. But like, their characters are American and British, respectively. So Donald Sutherland is working with, he's basically restoring a church in Venice, is his job. And he's working with a lot of Italian laborers and things. And he speaks some Italian to them. But it's real rough in places, and like, he just repeats simple words a lot to them, and very quickly, in most, that's with like the workmen, in most conversations people will say things to him in Italian and he immediately is like English, and if they don't know, he, so like, even his level of understanding of the language seemed weird, so it made him seem kind of like an ass to me. Because I'm like, first of all, you're not really trying. And second of all, you seem to be varying your level of effort in general. It's very odd. And then I find out later, like, this was very intentional, because miscommunication and communication barriers is a huge theme throughout. And sure enough, there's a lot of scenes that involve a lot of Italian, and there is nary a subtitle in the whole thing. So like, this was intentional to induce that feeling. And I understand that's a really clever and intriguing bit of film craft. In the moment, I was just like, this guy's kind of an ass and it's making it really hard to know what's going on. So like, both can be true.
Yeah.
And it also, I mean, because it is sort of focused on a couple who have lost their child recently and have suffered for it, it's also the story of people in a really fucked up relationship that don't treat each other well. And that's not fun for me, but I think it probably is a really great movie. I really didn't enjoy it. Meanwhile, the good news is the other two things I really did enjoy. We finished season 2 of Schmigadoon. I loved it like so much, which I'm still trying to parse, because I did not feel that way about season 1. I largely tolerated season 1. I wasn't bothered by it, and Trish liked it, so I kept watching. Near the end, I was a little more invested. Season 2, I was on board right away, and I adored everything about it. There are a couple of reasons that I'm playing with. Some of it is the second season is much more focused. Like I talked before, there sort of is an overarching plot to the whole series, and season 2 was much more dialed into that, to the degree that I find myself wondering how much they knew in season 1. Like, definitely some things, because there's definitely some stuff that is, but like, it, but also it's a change in the musical, like, because the show is so meta, the show is a musical, but it is also about musicals and has a lot of commentary on musicals, most commonly antiquated social norms in musicals, especially first season, because first season dealt with older musicals like Brigadoon, Music Man, Carousel, Steamboat, things like this. Musicals which by and large fall into two categories. Musicals I'm not at all familiar with, musicals I fucking hate, and musicals that are a little bit of both. Almost all musicals from that time period. I've sung a lot of the songs from them. I don't like them. So I think that was some of it. Season two is focused on musicals out of the 60s and 70s, which tend to be of a darker tone and a different sort of musical style. Chicago, Pippin, Hair, Jesus Christ Superstar, Sweeney Todd, things like that. I am more familiar with a lot of these and enjoy the music much more. And the second season especially parodies them brilliantly. They are, it is 100% original songs. And for 90% of them, I knew exactly which specific song they were very clearly playing at. There's actually a thing, there is some Sweeney Todd stuff in there, and instead of the lady who sells the pies and then the barber, we have the lady who runs an orphanage and he's a butcher. And one of her introductory things is a song called The Worst Brats in Town, which is very clearly just The Worst Pies in London, which is a song from Sweeney Todd. And they do a brilliant reprise of it when they go to the butcher called The Worst Brats in Town. And I found that very clever. They also make better use. In first season, we had a couple of really huge Broadway stars that were barely used. Like, they got like one song and three lines in the whole movie, or in the whole show. Those are better. Jane Krakowski and Kristen Chenoweth in particular are much better here. Also, Titus Burgess is in this. He was not in the first season. He is in this as the narrator. He's essentially doing the Ben Vereen character from Pippin, from the Broadway, the original Broadway run of Pippin, because he's dressed very like that and stuff. He does a marvelous job. I knew Titus Burgess. I think of Titus Burgess as a bit of a clownish character. He was Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. He does Dismantled and things on Roku, formerly Quibi, that kind of thing. And he's I mean, I love him, but he's a very much the sort of standard camp funny character. In this, first of all, he's showing off his Broadway chops. The man can sing.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. And he's real cool and smooth. And I was about halfway through the season where I was like, I think he's really hot in this too, which I've never felt that way about Titus Burgess. Not that I have anything against him, but like he's never, but this, I'm like, oh no, I'm doing it for me. So I was having fun with that. And then, yeah, there were better parts for some of the characters. I don't know, but I really love the second season. I absolutely think you've got to watch the whole thing. It is all an overarching story, and they're short. They're six episodes a season and they're half hour episodes. So if you like musicals, and in particular, if you are familiar with musicals, I cannot recommend the show enough. It's a very good.
Okay.
And then I got a weird one. We watched a movie last night, and it's a movie that I was browsing through Prime Video one night, and they were like, "Hey, you want to see this?" And I was like, "Prime, I've never given you any indication that this is something I'm at all interested in. But also, yes, I very much do want to see this." And so last night we actually watched it. It's called The Cheap Detective. I am very confused that this is not better known and that I didn't already know about this. Comedy. It is a film noir parody. It is very specifically a parody of Humphrey Bogart films, essentially. Casablanca, okay. Maltese Falcon, that kind of thing. It is a comedy. It is a very, like, absurdist comedy. Like, there is a running joke that our protagonist has pre-poured drinks of varying kinds just in drawers. Like, he wakes up in the morning and he pulls out his nightstand and there's just a shot in there. There's another time where he asks a woman if she'd like a drink in his office, and she's like, that'd be great. And he says, a dry martini? And she's like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, you want an onion or an olive? She's like, onion. And so he goes, and then he pauses and he goes to the drawer below and pulls out an already poured martini with an onion in it, and just silly things like that. And it has, is from 1978, it has the most amazing cast in the history of the world. The lead is Peter Falk.
Oh.
Already in love. Already.
Yeah. That's good. Peter Falk.
Sure. Dom DeLuise not playing Burt Reynolds brought me along for this movie. Like, Dom DeLuise back when he was hungry for, I feel really weird using that term, but like when he was trying hard, like, to be a comedian, and he does it. Like, Madeline Kahn.
Yeah.
I don't watch anything she's in.
Yeah.
Elaine Brannon in the similar vibe there. Anne Margaret. Sid Caesar. James Cromwell in a bit part. Like, young as hell, nobody, he was just in the featuring actors. Like, this was James Cromwell before anybody knew who the fuck he was. Paul Williams, John Houseman, who I don't know that I've ever seen act. I've just seen him in that old commercial about we don't make money, we earn it. doing a vaguely sort of Orson Welles character is amazing. And then, like, a billion other people who, if I told you, if I remembered their names and told you, you wouldn't recognize them, but you saw them, you would immediately. Oh, Scatman Carruthers, James Coco, just everyone, Abe Vigoda, the dude who played Mel in Alice's Diner, in Alice.
Oh, yeah.
I never remember his name, but he's a,
I don't either.
They are all, it's unbelievable. They, oh, Stockard Channing, like,
what.
There is almost no act. There is a huge cast, and almost none of them would you not recognize at least on site. It's insane. And it's written by Neil Simon.
Oh, really?
Yes. How do we not all know about this movie?
I don't. That, yeah. I've never heard of it. How? That's wild.
It's that's crazy. Wild. Everybody's in this thing. There's also the guy, I can't remember his, I never remember his name. He was a recurring character on Breaking Bad that I didn't see. He's the guy they basically brought in to replace Chevy Chase on Community. He was the cranky old guy when they needed a new cranky old guy. You definitely know him if you saw him, and I can't remember his name. And shows up in just the tiniest part. He's in, like, he delivers a message or something. But I'm like, oh my God, it's that guy. I think his name's Mikey on Breaking Bad. I don't know. But everybody's in this movie, including some of them. I'm like, I don't even know why you're here. And it's very silly. And it holds up. It is remarkably not problematic. I mean, it's not perfect. It's the 70s. But the racism is and xenophobia is just a whisper. You could probably get away with all of it today. There's a couple of bits about how Asian people have funny names, but nobody's doing any weird accents or anything, except German ones, because it's set in the beginning of World War II. And actually, there is a joke involving Asians having funny names that is lampshaded and is the most hilarious thing in the movie for me, but I don't want to spoil it. It's a great joke. We both just cracked up. And this is weird to say. There is a great deal of sexism and chauvinism within the film. However, it is self-aware, and you're not supposed to be on the side of the chauvinist. And in fact, the opening crawl or whatever, because it has a little thing describing what's happening. Although mostly it describes historical events that it literally have nothing to do with the movie, and it says that. But it sort of talks about back in the day where you could beat up a dame and no one would bat an eye and things like that. And like, there's that vibe, but it's very clearly ridiculous. And I will say, there's a ton of female characters, and I would argue they have as much, if not more, agency than most of the male characters. It's by no means perfect, but it is, it's not that problematic, especially for the 70s and for a broad comedy in the 70s. Trish didn't like it quite as well as me. I will say it's only 93 minutes and it seemed to go on. It is one of those that does Return of the King. It has like five endings. And so I'm sitting here, I'm like, oh God, is it over now? No, we got another. Okay, what about now? And so it's possible I might just love it because I love all these actors and because I love everything from the 70s. I'm always fascinated, but I really enjoyed it. And it's included with Prime. It's just on Prime for free. The Cheap Detective.
There was a time back then where it was kind of a genre where you would have a film with just tons and tons of people in it. You know, Mad World.
They were often these sort of comedies.
Screwball comedies. And like, you know, one of these, I think it was the one I just mentioned, had like Buster Keaton's in it for just a second. And he has a speaking part and everything. And you're like, that's Buster Keaton. And they basically, half the entertainment is the cameos or people showing up. And
Oh, yeah.
I know who that is, that kind of thing. They made a lot of films like that for a little while there in the late 70s and early 80s, I want to say.
Yeah. But this one, surprisingly few cameos. Most everybody has like real.
Oh, okay. I mean, characters. That's a huge
Caesar
cast.
Only has one scene, but it's a pretty long scene.
I mean, that was probably a cameo. I mean,
ish. Yeah. Yeah. His part is to basically make Sid Caesar faces. He doesn't even have that many lines. And heavy makeup involved. And
yeah. Right.
But, right. And several people, like, seriously, I will watch anything Peter Falk is in, and I will watch anything Madeline Kahn is in. Straight
up. She's amazing.
Love them both. And they're both very good in this. Madeline Kahn in particular. Madeline Kahn's amazing. As time went on, people tended to write bigger and bigger for her. And it felt like a waste. I mean, she can actually do a dramatic act pretty well, but she is a comedian. Was a comedian, but she can do it subtle and straight and like deadpan and things, and there's a lot of that in here, and it's done really well. And yeah, and this is also back in the day where nobody was funding it and everybody was trying their darndest. I would definitely recommend it, especially the price point is great. So yeah, check that out. All right. Enough of that bullshit. Give us an email.
Well, okay.
I decided then that the best way for this to work is that you always do it, and I don't got to do anything, so that's nice.
Uh-huh.
Problem is, you barely know how to read.
Stu says...
Stu! Hello, Stu!
What is the most trivial question ever submitted to the hat? Well, in a great stroke of irony, I just read it, I think.
No, I would say there is sort of a montage of 90% of Azure Talent's questions. I'll tell you the really trivial one that I really love, and I hate saying it because I do believe it is Azure Talent. It was either Azure Talent or Bloodsport, but I think it was Azure Talent. Just said, make them talk about soup.
Oh.
I don't even remember what we then talked about. I mean, soup, presumably. I don't even know what we said. But it was just like, make them talk about soup.
I mean, I was being facetious, obviously. I guess I don't think of... I've never noted any of the questions to be particularly trivial. Sometimes difficult to understand or difficult to come up with anything to talk about. trivial. Give me an example of a trivial question. Not a trivia question, but a trivial question.
I just said, make them talk about soup.
How's that trivial, though? Because that could be, you could go on and on and on about soup. Either one of us probably could.
Yes. Trivial doesn't imply length.
Yeah, what does it imply? Does it imply just mundane? Implies
a lack of significance. I believe there are three types of questions we get almost exclusively.
Well, this will be good. Right, I've never thought about questions.
Emails. Three.
I never thought about this before.
I've thought about this extensively.
Well, enlighten me, because I never have.
One is genuine, heartfelt, really thought out, like this is a real interesting concept or philosophical position. Okay. What do you think of that? A lot of our questions are this.
I'm getting
almost it. All of Jazz's questions are this, but a lot of questions from a lot of our listeners are like, this is a real thing that I would, you know, at a dinner party or whatever, I would bring up with people if they were close, trusted friends. Let's talk about this. This is a real issue. Sure. This is a real philosophical debate to be had. The second version is some shit just happened to me, and I want you to talk about it. Like, I just watched a thing, or something just happened that really ground my gears. Or literally, I had an experience yesterday. How do you feel about that experience? That kind of thing. Very personal, in the moment questions. Sometimes can still be, very deep and elaborate stuff, but it's very clear. Some emails you look at, and even if they don't say, you're like, oh, this person clearly had this happen to them recently. And then the third one, which ebbs and flows depending on how needy I get, is shit, they wanted something. All right, how about this? Here's a thing that technically involves enough nouns they could talk about it. Enjoy. And that is, those tend to be very trivial, but also very much because they're doing us a favor.
So trivial as in inconsequential, like there's nothing.
I believe that is a fair synonym.
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking like that for some reason.
But most of them really aren't. I mean, the only times I think questions are truly trivial from our listeners is when they are trying to be trivial, where essentially it is a joke of, I'm going to send you an email about something so dumb and you're going to talk about it. And that's kind of funny, which is 100% valid way to do it, without a doubt.
Yeah. I mean, Azure Talon seems to have the goal of, how can I make them regret this premise? How can I make
Azure Talon is also one of our workhorses when I complain about needing more stuff. Right. I will complain about it on Thursday, post the podcast on Friday. I have 12 of the most inane emails ever. It's also the ones where they aren't spelled correctly, and I can tell he just did it from his phone.
I think Azure Talon, when he leaves this mortal plane, will become a genie that wishes, like, that gives three wishes.
But like monkey's paw wishes, definitely.
Yeah, like devious. Yeah, he'll be one of those devious.
This is some wishmaster bullshit here. Yeah. No matter what you wish for, I kill you. Like,
yeah.
Seriously, that's the premise of the, I believe, 4 movie series of Wishmaster. Is there's this djinn, and whatever you wish for, he'll kill you.
Yeah, that's him for sure. But this is
a little bit what the premise was for The Hellraiser reboot.
This is he likes to give people what they wish for and make them regret wishing for it. That's his his jam.
Yep. He has a blue claw on a monkey's paw. I realized about halfway through that was going to rhyme.
Yeah, good job.
And decided, fuck it. Yep. And as much as I enjoyed True Crime People, I think Blue Claw and a Monkey's Paw has to be the episode title.
Good. Oh, I love it. I love it when a plan comes together.
It's either that or no soup talk for you. Which is good, but not as organic. Oh my god. So we had some, I don't know what it is, but Trish was reading something. There was some definition we need of a scientific term, and it had to do with whether or not basically it brought up the concept of inorganic carbon. I had a problem with this because I was taught in school that calling something organic means it contains carbon. Now, I'm not talking about organic like organic farm.
No, I know.
I'm talking in the chemical term. That is literally in multiple science classes in secondary and post-secondary, the definition of organic was containing carbon. So, how do you have inorganic carbon? Do you know? I mean,
I presume it's carbon that is not derived from an organic source, like fossil fuels are organic carbons. But you can have carbon that's made in, like, the sun, a star will make carbon, and that's not made by, that doesn't come about by organic means, is what I would presume it means.
I don't like that answer because it's wrong technically, but it's right generally.
Oh, okay.
That is not how you define inorganic carbon. However, that is frequently the separation by which you find inorganic carbon versus organic carbon. It turns out, as is often the case in school, when you look back at it like 20 or 30 years later, their definition was a little too vague. Technically, to be organic, you are a compound that contains carbon-hydrogen bonds.
Oh.
Specifically.
Okay. I don't think
if you have carbon, that, but it doesn't have that bond with hydrogen, it doesn't count. It is extremely rare in nature. It is found much more commonly in synthetic productions that involve carbon.
Rare in nature.
Yes, it is not commonly found in nature. As a compound, you can find pure carbon. That's, I guess, technically that would be inorganic too. But when it comes to organic is an adjective that modifies a molecular compound.
Sure. But isn't that carbon hydrogen thing? Isn't that like a in other molecules and stuff that make them organic molecules and organic?
Yeah,
compounds?
Yeah. It's not just compounds that contain carbon and hydrogen. It's somewhere, you know, you remember the old thing. We got the balls of the atoms and we got the lines. There needs to be a line between a carbon atom and a hydrogen atom somewhere.
Right.
If it's got that, organic.
Like carbohydrates, I think, have that. I think.
I would imagine.
Carbohydrates. And
I mean, most compounds that involve carbon do. So,
yeah. But just by itself, the carbon, just all by itself, is not common in nature.
I think so. I mean, is that a thing? Is there a compound made up of just carbon and hydrogen atoms? Probably. I think it would definitely be organic. But if it's, say, if you have a compound that has carbon but has no hydrogen, that would not be organic.
I see. I see.
I don't know if it's possible to have a compound with carbon and hydrogen, but they're on different sides, so they never touch. That could be. But I don't know. We have, we 3 minutes ago, we exhausted my knowledge.
Me too. I mean, when it comes chemistry.
Oh, we exhausted your knowledge at hour ago.
I mean, I'm okay with some chemistry stuff, but most of it. I mean, I took chemistry in college and I followed along with it okay. I think I got an A in the class and everything, but it was really hard. It didn't really sink in or stick.
I did very little chemistry.
Abby loves chemistry, biochemistry in particular, and she's really good at understanding all that stuff. But it's kind of like I took lots and lots of classes of French, but I can't speak it. It's like that, where it's like, while I'm taking this class, I can follow along and get a decent grade, but when the class is over, I'm not going to remember any of this stuff. Chemistry just, for some reason, doesn't sink in for me. I don't know why.
I didn't take chemistry in high school. It just didn't work out that way. It was typically a junior year thing, and there was an AP version. I just didn't take it. I was taking other shit. And then in college, I took exactly one chemistry course. It was chemistry 98, I think. You know how the 101 is the intro course to a thing, and then this was the low 101. And it was called Chemistry is Everywhere.
Chemistry is Everywhere. Wow.
Yes. And
a lot of Schoolhouse Rock, I guess.
Yeah, it was commonly held. This is chemistry for dummies. And it's why we all took it, because we all needed to have a hard science credit somewhere, and this was our easiest way to do it. It was more accurate, and actually the professor specified, it's more accurate to say it was chemistry for non-science majors, because what it was each chapter of our primary text dealt with a concept or an issue, and then we really dove into it. So there was a chapter on climate change, and we got into what that means and why that's like that and how the greenhouse gases work and all, and we got into the chemistry of all of that, but also the social implications and all that kind of thing. We had a chapter on drugs, in which we learned how do drugs work in the body, how do the receptors work and things like that, and how do they connect and all that sort of thing. So it was really interesting, and I learned a ton in there, but it was little to no math, to give it perspective. There was also a physics version of it called, there was a physics class that was below 101. It's called The Universe and Its Structure. That was a similar kind of deal. I don't know why I went for the chemistry one.
I really liked
better time.
I liked my chemistry class. I wish when I'd taken it, again, I don't really remember anything, but I wish when I'd taken it, I'd taken the lab, because you had to take two science courses and one with a lab. And I took astronomy with a lab, and that was a disaster. That was just a disaster.
You get dropping stars on the floor and things during the...
No, it just involved...
They fall out of the Petri dish.
No, it just involved, you had to there was a procedure with a string with knots, and you had to go outside and make observations and all this stuff. And it was nope, it didn't work. I think I failed that part of the course even. I mean, it was just, now the classroom part of the course, again, fine. I mean, I got all that classroom stuff, I got A's, but I think I actually failed the lab portion of the course. Which
anything
I still passed the course.
Further away than 50 yards, you're no good. Maybe you just needed glasses. Was that?
I don't know. I didn't fully understand what we were supposed to be doing with the string, with the knots and everything. And when I asked people, I didn't even understand their answers. And it's like, it was the only experience I've ever had in any school situation where I didn't know what was going on. Most of the time, I completely understand some instructions or I can ask questions intelligently enough, I can figure it out. This one, no matter what I simply did not know what I was doing. And by the time it was over and I was turning in my lab results, I knew it was garbage. I knew it and I couldn't do anything about it. By then it was too late.
How you became a flat earther.
I just hoped to pass. And that's the only class in my whole life. I don't care if it's elementary school, any class in my whole life. That's the first one where I ever was like, gosh, I hope I just pass. And I did barely. That's the only class ever in my life that I've only barely just passed because of that stupid lab that I never, to this day, I couldn't tell you how I was supposed to do it.
If you know how William was supposed to do it,
I bet someone knows. I'll bet someone knows because they've probably heard of this knots on string thing where like you track the moon or some, I don't even know. I didn't understand it at all.
If you know, go to the comments or YouTube comments also and tell William what the fuck he's talking about because he doesn't know. Or I still don't know, but are confident in your ability to bullshit, make something up. See if you can convince him it's true. I'll find that hilarious. Also, show up to either of those places and tell us your thoughts on anything we've talked about. Any of you guys seen The Cheap Detective? Any of you all watching Schmigadoon? Which one of us do you love better? Vis-a-vis Only Murders in the Building. Again, I think society is on William's side. But that's usually the case. Society and I don't get along. Smash that like button. Write in themagicaltalkinghead@gmail.com. See if you can get more Trivial Than Soup. That's a goal. Or see if you can write a question that is in a fourth category that I didn't list. I think it'd be hard because my categories were real freaking nebulous, but you're up for the challenge. I'm shopping around catchphrases lately. So if you've got any good catchphrases for me, go and tell me in the blog or on YouTube. Currently, I'm operating with "What up? I'm three," and "Here comes Creepy Dave."
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.